Well, my name's Stan Rowland. Probably I ought to tell you a little bit about myself so you know where I'm coming from. I'm a businessman by training. I was trained in, before any one of you guys were born, I was trained in business. And I worked in business for a large company for 15 years, and then I started a healthcare company. So my background is business, marketing, that type of thing. But in 1977, so I said that was before all of you were born, Crew had a movement called the Agape Movement. And the Agape, the easiest way to describe it, it was a Christian Peace Corps. In other words, young college graduates that had vocational skills went overseas to begin to share their faith in their workplace. In other words, at a school, at a hospital, those types of things. And that enamored me. God hit me over the head and said, join the Agape Movement. I was a business guy, 40 years old, which back then was an old fogey for Crusade. And Dr. Bright heard I had a medical background, and he said, Dr. Bright said, I have a vision. The vision is to integrate curative care, health education, in other words, prevention, and of course, evangelism, and discipleship. And we want to raise up young people overseas, nationals, that don't necessarily even have a high school education to be a barefoot doctor. So we put, Dr. Bright was good at that with Campus Crusade, and he said, put that together. And then in 1980, we went overseas to try the first products. And so we moved, my family and I moved to Uganda, where we started this program called CHE, Community Health Evangelism. And what it was all about was finding a person of peace, entering the community through that person of peace, finding out what the community wanted to deal with. We didn't ask what their needs were. We said, what were your assets? What do you have? And what would you like to learn? What would you like to change? And what do you need to learn so that you can change it? And then we began to teach them how to change their place and to change themselves, because evangelism and Jesus Christ was at the center. So we did that through from 80 to 90 in Africa. We lived in Uganda from 80 to 85, and then from 85 to 90, we lived in Kenya, spreading this concept through Campus Crusade all across English-speaking Africa, not French, but English-speaking. But then Crusade dropped the Agape Movement. But we had started and trained people from about 100 different organizations in about 15 countries how to do this. So we said, we're going to leave. Can we take this CHE with us? And that's what we did. And we plugged it into a new organization. And today, CHE is being used in 125 countries of the world by over 500 different groups, organizations. It's still going all over the world. And it is about 6,000 villages. So it's something that's continual. So why am I here? About 2007, we said, how can we begin to impact the urban poor here in the U.S.? So we changed the name of it from Community Health Evangelism to Neighborhood Transformation. And so what we're all about is helping different groups, whether it be a church or a network or an organization, see transformation of individuals, which Crew is fantastic at, and transformation of a place. And Crew Inner City is focused on places. And the problem with Crew, they understood that it's really a neighborhood approach. You don't transform Chicago in one fell swoop. You got to break it down into small pieces. And so we work with churches and neighborhoods in multiple cities across the U.S., training them how and coming alongside them, coaching them, finding out where they're at, and then saying, how can we help you complete your mission? And so I'm here, to be honest, to get Crew Inner City back interested in something they started so many years ago. And so that's the background. So what I want to do is share with you some ideas. Now, you guys are all working in the inner city. Picture in your mind what comes into most people's minds when I say inner city. If you were to ask a white church, and I use the word inner city, what would be some words that would describe that inner city that they would come up with? I know you wouldn't, but they might. Crime, yes. What else? Homelessness, yes. Poverty, yeah, in a big way, yes. And what kind of poverty? That's a loaded question. Well, they generally think about economic poverty. But is poverty just economic? You don't know it, but that would be some of the things that would come up. Now picture in your mind a suburban neighborhood. What comes to your mind when the word suburban neighborhood? Pardon? Yes, lots of commercial businesses. Okay, what else? Yeah, many high-earning jobs, high-earning jobs. Yep, what else? Clean, little graffiti. And in an inner-city neighborhood, would people be... And this is a good place to live. But in a suburban neighborhood, not all, but in the people would like their place. So there is a real problem. Well, what I hope to do today is to present ideas that might help you change the way people think about the inner city, and more importantly, not just think, not just talk, but help the people in the inner city change their place. So that's kind of where we're at. How many of you know what that is? That's an iceberg. And how we view poverty is shaped by our culture. And last night we heard two very, very distinct views than if you were a white or a middle class person. And that really shapes your view of a place. And so culture really does shape our view and the culture that we're talking about, society, what's in it. What are the real underlying causes of poverty? What are some of the underlying causes of poverty? Lack of resources, yes. And when you say resources, define the word resources for me. Okay. Yeah, so lack of physical things, food basis, lack of homeliness, lack of transportation. What else? That is a result, most of those are the result of a place being poor, but it's not really the cause of poverty. What would be some underlying? Lack of resources would be an underlying one. Okay, what else? Yes. Yeah, hopelessness. Right. Right. There's no way out. I can't escape. I'm trapped. And those, all of those. What other? Yes, lack of jobs. Okay, health and two different ones. Lack of employment, or if they are employed, they're grossly underemployed. And what does that mean, underemployed? That's a first term. Okay, in other words, they're...
I was going to say that...
Yep, in other words... Yeah.
It pushes you down.
It pushes you down instead of up. And they've got minimum wage jobs, so in the last year with this whole thing that's been going on to raise the minimum wage, that's a help. But even if we do raise it to $15 an hour, will that be enough for people to live? Depends. In L.A., absolutely not. But in Pocahontas, Idaho, maybe. Or wherever. Okay. And so these are some of the political system, as we talked about, as was talked about last night, is a very, very structural cause. And when you looked at welfare, the original welfare, a family could not get welfare if there was a man in the house, because the man in the house could take the labor, in theory. So there were unfair trade practices. So there are many reasons why there's poverty in an area. But a structural is one. And the way outsiders look at poverty and the way people in that area look at poverty compound and cause it to happen. So what we hope to do is, what do you see? You've seen this picture before, I'm sure. This is an oldie. What do you see there? There's an old woman, yeah? And a young woman. Now, when you first see this, how many of you saw, think about the first time you've seen this. Did you see two or did you see one? The first time most people saw one. But which one did they see? It could be either one. But now that you've seen this, you know. But it's how we look at things, how we view our world. And so we need to begin to shift the way we think and the way we do things. Let's talk a little bit. Well, so alleviating poverty begins with how we view our world, both insiders and outsiders, and government and everybody else. So we've got to begin to, if we're going to alleviate poverty, we've got to begin to play with people's minds. And it's all about change, both insiders and outsiders. Have any of you been exposed to Ruby Payne's writing, Bridges to Understanding? Understanding Poverty. And she says and teaches, and it's being taught around the U.S., that the way your worldview is controlled by your wealth. People that grow up in an urban slum have the same worldview. Doesn't matter what their ethnicity is. Middle class grow up with a different worldview. And rich grow up with a very, very different worldview than the middle class. And so partly what her thesis is, and I agree with it, and we teach it some once in a while, is that unless you understand the different worldviews related to wealth, you're never going to be able to see transformation. Change takes place. Now, she's not a Christian, but it's a good. So what we believe totally is the underpinnings that everything we teach is based on a biblical worldview. And you've been hearing some of that biblical worldview here, and Crew teaches it. It teaches we're all made in the image of God, and we're his stewards, and his resources were put in our control to be used for ourselves, for the good of his kingdom. And so where we're coming from, and where you would assume we're coming from or expect us to come from, is a biblical worldview. What you've been hearing, why you've been here for this. Now, one thing that not everybody has, and in the early days, Crew didn't have it, to be honest, but they do now very much, and that's a holistic worldview that sees word and deed as one. In other words, it's not if we just do evangelism, then the world will be good. Or if we come from the persuasion of justice, all we got to do is do justice and everything will be fine. The key thing is it's holistic, a view that says change comes about when mind, body, soul, and spirit are one. You all know, well, Luke 10:27 is the premier one. Does anybody know what Luke 10? Love God. And your neighbor as yourself. And the first part, I say, is easy. It isn't. But the second part, unless you're under the guidance of the Holy Spirit, is it doesn't happen. Love your neighbor as yourself. And that's what we're talking about. And that's what Crew's talking about. Loving your neighbor as yourself. So what do you do for yourself? What do you do for yourself if you can? Yeah? Okay, what else?
Good nutrition and physical fitness.
Right. In other words, we do as much as we can for ourselves. Yes, there are dysfunctional people, and all of us are dysfunctional in one way or another. But what we, our whole view and Crew's whole view is, how do you integrate physical, spiritual, emotional, and social? You aren't just interested in seeing people come to Christ. That's underlying, absolutely. But there are all the other elements. The key, what's the key? And we've been talking about it this week. What's the key to seeing change in people? What's the key? The key is relationships. If I don't have a relationship with you, nothing's going to happen. Now, I'm going to ask you a question. Where you live now, whether it's in an apartment or whether it's in a house or wherever, you know the game tic-tac-toe? Your house is in the center. And there are 8 groups of people living around you. Those are the 8 blank spaces around you. Could be an apartment, could be in the suburbs, could be wherever. How many of you can name the names of the 8 people around you? In other words, can anybody name all 8 last names, Joneses or Browns, let alone Mary is there, Mary Jones, Bob Brown, you know, etc. Nobody in the U.S. in cities knows their neighbors. So what does that tell us about relationships? Pardon?
They're lacking.
They're lacking. There is no relationship. And what do we do if we have a garage and we drive down the street? What do we do when we drive down the street? Yeah, you press the button for your garage, so your garage door goes up, and then you go in. Now, depending upon the neighborhoods, not everybody has garage doors, but the point is, nobody knows their neighbors, and in the U.S., most don't want to know their neighbors. That's very different than in a place overseas, in a village overseas. Everybody knows their neighbors. So one of the things that's important if you're going to have change, no matter what type of place you're living, people have to know their neighbors and reach out to help them. Did any of you, okay, you guys are all pretty young, but but did any of you grow up in a small town or a village? Okay. And when you were growing up, when you did something wrong, who corrected you? In the area though. Right. Right. Exactly. That's right. Exactly. And that's very true. And we used to have that here in the U.S., but we don't anymore. And so this is a real problem. So if you're going to see change, if you want to share Jesus with people, you need a relationship with them. Now, yes, I was taught in the early days of Crusade, you go witness to everybody. But typically, if I shared with you, and it was the first time anybody shared with you, you had to hear the gospel multiple times. Like the Billy Graham Crusades, a high percentage of the people were brought there by somebody that somebody had been sharing with for a long time, and therefore they had a good response. But it was based on the relationship of the friend that brought them, not on their relationship with Billy Graham, but there was a relationship between the parent and the person that brought them. So relationships is critical. And so if you're going to see change, you have to reinstitute relationships. Oops. We're committed to the poor and the marginalized. And that's a critical, and we really are committed to it by neighborhoods. We're committed to long-term solutions, not quick fixes. Some churches today, it's a major step forward. They do work days. Do any of the churches you do work days? In other words, they mobilize the people from the church. They go to a specific neighborhood and they work. But the problem is that it's only sporadic. And if you're going to, the whole key of doing that is developing relationships. But who do the people develop relationships with? The people from the church that are cleaning up the park, not the people from the neighborhood. And so you want to have long-term solutions that work on prevention, that works on changing systems, and works on intervention. We're totally, as I've been saying, committed to commitment to change a place. In other words, and a place has to be small. It can't be the city of Houston or the city of Chicago. It's got to be a neighborhood. Some of you are from Chicago. You all know the Lawndale program. Now, that's a big neighborhood, but it's split in two because that neighborhood had one segment of it, where they started, was with African American. The other side is Latino. And they're under one umbrella, but they're two separate neighborhoods. And so you have to be committed to local ownership and initiative. What do you think that means, local ownership? What does that mean? Well, too many programs, you see a church come in, look at a cleanup, and they say, look what we did. Is that local ownership? No, no. So what you want is the people in the community to say, look what we did. Now, we also want them to say under God's direction, too, but because he's the real change agent. But the key is we want local ownership and initiative. And that means you want to start a program with people from the neighborhood as much as possible as you can. Now, one of the key things that we're heavily involved in is most people, are any of you medical people or social workers or that kind of thing? And you've been taught to do needs assessment, right? That's your, and if you're doing it right, you do a needs assessment, you report it back to the community, and then you do what the community wants. That's the good guys. But What happens when I come in and I say, what's your need? And they say, well, I need this. Okay. And what happens then when I say, okay, I can help you with that, and you fix the need? What does that say to the person who told you their need? Over a period of time, what happens?
Dependence.
They become dependent, and they begin to think unconsciously, okay, I told you my need, now you guys are going to fix it for me, right? And I hate to say that, but that's what we're doing in welfare. That's the center of welfare. But don't get me going. So we say, what are your skills? Well, we use 9 questions. First question is, when we're talking with people, what do you like about this place? Second question, if you could change one thing in this place, what would you change? Third thing, are there any local groups in this neighborhood that are just here? I don't care what they're doing. It could be the guys that meet every Saturday at the basketball hoop just to shoot hoops. Not a league, but I mean just the stuff that happens spontaneously. And then the next question is, what skill do you have that might be of value? And you got to do a little digging and asking that, because most people will say, I don't have anything. So you got to keep digging. And people say, well, I know how to bake cakes. Okay, that's fine. Or I do hospitality, or I walk dogs, or whatever. Next question is, what do you know that might be of value? Well, I know how to teach some to play guitar. We've had a couple of people say, well, to be honest, I know how to work the system. Now, that's not what you're looking for, but that's an example, you know. And then the next question is, what would you like to learn if teaching were done here in this place? And then you ask them, can I pray for you? What can I pray for you for? Now, I've worked in about 15 Muslim countries. The Stan countries, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, you know, the Southern Russian Republics, and Morocco. I've never had a Muslim say, no, you're a Christian, don't pray for me. People will give you a response. And then you come back after, and you need to be praying for whatever the person said, no matter how ridiculous it might sound to you. And then after a couple of weeks, you came back. After you've tabulated the results, you tabulate them and you report back to the community what the results were. And then you set up little training opportunities. There are 5 elements here. And they're almost extremes. In today's society, evangelism is critical because that's the entry point. But what do most of us Christians do? We don't do discipleship. And we had a whole session on the criticalness of discipleship, mentoring, coaching. Most Christians do things for people instead of empowering them to do things for themselves. That's where change comes. Most people will either do word and deed, evangelism, social action, social justice. Some people focus on needs and some focus on assets. And being a good crusader is addition. Good. If I win you to Christ, is that good? But what's much, 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 much better? I teach you to be a multiplying disciple. Well, everything, you need both ends. You need all of these things in to be working together. And generally, you'll start with one or two of these things. But you're really looking for all of those things. We've talked about people don't know their neighbors. And we talked about knowing their names and developing relationships and trust. Now, one of the things that we believe is critical is how do you teach people? Now, Crew's getting much, much better at this. But when you go to seminars, what do you see? You see stuff like this. PowerPoint, one guy babbling at you like me. But that's not the way to teach. If you want to see change, you've got to involve people in their own learning. So, have any of you heard the word facilitator? A facilitator who brings out answers, but what we teach you to do is guided facilitation. Meaning that if you do pure facilitation, every answer is taken, no matter how bad it might be. And in guided participation, they are questions that you would bring one piece of the answer, and you'd bring another, and you'd bring another, and you bring another. So it's group dynamics teaching. And so everything that our teaching style is, we get people in a small group. We don't sit in this kind of setup. And we sit in a circle. Why is it better to sit in a circle? Pardon? You get to know each other. What else? Yes, right. That's right. Everybody's equal power, including the facilitator. Okay, what else? Yes, you're face to face to each other. So you can see each other. So you don't have back row, two circles. You only have one circle. So that keeps, now there's an advantage. Learning really takes place much better, but your groups can't be much over 25. Because in this room, you could get a big circle and maybe get 35, but part of the problem would be hearing. Because we ask a question, and where do the answers come from? Did I say? Everybody in the room. One piece by one piece. And through that, you build a group knowledge. So participatory teaching is critical. Now, we're all about scaling up. One of the things when we lived in Africa, guys would go out as agriculturalists. They'd teach a farmer to change, to do something, to grow vegetables, tomatoes. And the farmer did it. That was super. But all you're doing is helping one person at a time. What you're really after is a movement. And that's what's happened in Jay internationally. It's a movement that's being used in 125 countries by over 700 different groups in over 7,000 villages, and nobody controls it. We don't control it. It's because of multiplication. 2 Timothy 2:2. The key thing, also very important, is we're after servant leadership, Christian servant leadership. Change is central. If there's no change, then we haven't been successful. So there are many ways to change. We believe the way you change, well, what we do is all about change. What Crew City's inner city's trying to do is change. Very much individuals, a question I would ask, aren't neighborhoods actually being changed? I don't know. It's a question I always ask. As I said, group learning beats individual learning. So we are not horribly good on online teaching courses because the group dynamics isn't there. Now, if you're, and you can set up forums, and if you're going for a grade or something like that, then the teacher kind of can grade you on, but we aren't going for a grade. We're going for actual implementation. So the way most of our teaching is face-to-face in small groups, but we equip people in the local church, well, equip, let's say, Crew inner city people, say in a given city, how to introduce and train people in the church to do it, and then they act as the facilitator in the neighborhood where they're going to be working. Key thing is, we all think we're lone rangers, but we aren't. We can't do things alone. And so everything is built on how do you involve people? How do you empower people to work together as a group to see individuals and neighborhoods changed? One of the key things that you want to do is go where people are, join in with what they're doing and what they already know. So you don't go in to totally revamp a person. You want most people that come to a class, why do they come to any given class, no matter what it is, unless you're required to come? But why? Why do most adults? Yeah, there's some interest in that particular topic. And if there's some interest, even if they're neophytes, they've got some knowledge. And in the group will be people that have more knowledge. And so you aren't trying to change. What we're talking with Crew Inner City about is, where are you now? And many of the Crew Inner City are heavily into the love box, I think you call it. Boxes of love. Power packs, yeah. And it really can mobilize volunteers, but it's not continuous. It's sporadic in general. The real purpose, and Crusade teaches this, is to build relationships with the people in the place. But does it? I'll leave it at that. Right. Yes, exactly. But do they? See.
Some do, some don't.
And it's got to be, your service needs to be, the local church needs to be doing it regularly, not just once or twice a year. You need to be reaching out and actually trying to develop relationships. There are three things. Doing relief, which is doing things for people. Coming alongside, which is mentoring and coaching to help a person change what they want to change. And then the third one is where you really empower them and they begin to multiply, to be the multiplier. Coaching, as you heard today, is critical to change. And are we always going to be successful? Absolutely not. So that means you're going to fall on your face. And you can't say, I quit. They were talking about that yesterday and today. What we're after eventually is to see as many of those five elements, you know, in that pentagon that I had working. But you're lucky if you start with one. Our purpose then is transforming people and place by disciple making, integrating word and deed, and getting people focused on transforming a neighborhood, a place, and seeing people and groups multiply. We do that by teaching people how to connect with their neighbors. And then once they connect, how do you begin to create a community where there is none? And then once you create some small communities within the neighborhood, how do you network them together to transform that neighborhood? So it's a process. We've got many reproducible tools, and what you see there, I'm surprised you can read it. I looked at it, I wouldn't. But each one of those things that is there, building a relationship is a workshop. A workshop is from 4 to 8 hours. That could be done one night a week or one day a week or on a Saturday. They're all in this participatory style. So these are just some of the topics. There are over 85 of those topics that we have. Now, we have them on we used to have them on a DVD, but now we're with the times and we've got them on a flash drive in both Word so that you can change them and in Adobe, so you can print them out. So, my question, do any of these ideas, are you doing any of them? Do any of them resonate with you? I know you're probably doing some of these. Yeah.
In cooperation with Chris. And, you know, we would do that, but it wasn't us going out into the community. We were expecting the community to come to us.
Yes.
And then if they did come to us and we had all of our information, it was like pulling teeth to get them to follow up with the people later on. So we had a lot of opportunity. To work with
Right. And part of the issue, you've hit two or three issues, really. One, most of us expect people to come to us instead of us going to them, to meet them on their turf, where they're at. And that's important. Secondly, you need a small team within the church that really buys the concepts. But most people in churches don't buy these concepts. So there's a lot of preparation in worldview that have to be changed. We're beginning to work. There are different kinds of churches. And there's a church group called Missional Church. Have you heard of that? Those are churches that are on mission. Every person's a missionary, no matter where they're at. You don't have to go overseas to be a missionary. You be a missionary here. Some of those guys have actually planted their church in a given neighborhood, and they want to see that neighborhood changed. And those are much better churches to work with, to be honest. It's not like pulling them, it's not as bad as pulling impacted molars like sometimes we see. And so you've got to select. Historically, crew teaches, and I teach and have done, whoever's interested, I'll teach. But that doesn't necessarily mean they're in line with our line of thinking. It's very hard to get people in the church to learn how to do pure evangelism, right? But that's only the very first step. That's the tiny tip of the iceberg. It's that discipling. And so you need different people, to find people that are with the vision.